I think it's a turnaround COP because this year, the Paris Agreement's goal to limit the increase in the global average temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels was acknowledged as inevitable. So this was, I think, the elephant in the room during negotiations, a defining goal of the Paris Agreement that we've now failed to meet. I think it's too early to tell what this COP means for the future of the process, but I did feel that it was substantially different in a few ways than previous COPs.
As the world takes stock of the outcomes of COP30 in Belém, a broad consensus is emerging. While the summit delivered several meaningful advances, it ultimately fell short of the transformational shift that many had hoped for. Most observers see COP30 as a measured success. It moved the system toward greater coherence, inclusion, and implementation, but didn't deliver the deeper reforms needed to accelerate global climate action. I'm Jack Dorrell, Head of Communications at UNUCPR, and in today's episode of Multilateralism Unpacked, I speak to Michael Franczak, senior researcher who was on the ground in Belém. Our conversation explores the context surrounding COP30 and how shrinking aid budgets, the absence of the United States and Europe's energy and security pressures conspired to produce a very different COP this time around. While acknowledging meaningful steps forward, for example, on trade and the emergence of subnational leaders, the interview does not shy away from the setbacks. No significant new finance pledges emerged, countries could not agree on fossil fuel phase-out language, and concerns deepened about how to mobilize the public finance needed to support developing countries. We also look ahead, thinking through how we can navigate the obstacles holding back the global climate agenda and how we can leverage political and financial openings to build on the achievements that emerged from COP30. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Mike, thanks for speaking to me today. You were in Belém for COP30, and I wanted to start by asking you to reflect on the outcomes. Earlier in the year, we hosted the COP30 president, Ambassador André Correa de Lago, and he referred to COP30 as a turnaround COP, a term that he used in the podcast we recorded with him here in New York earlier this year. Did COP30, in your opinion, represent a turnaround?
Thanks, Jack. It's good to be here. The phrase turnaround COP refers to the idea that we're moving now from negotiation to implementation. 10 years ago, parties negotiated the Paris Agreement, and 10 years out, we've now negotiated all of the aspects that needed to be settled to operationalize it. So what Ambassador de Lago is referring to is this idea that we now need to move to the implementation of the Paris Agreement. So yes, in a sense, the big negotiations have ended. The so-called Paris rulebook is complete. And the Paris Agreement policy cycle, based around the nationally determined contributions and the ratchet mechanism, is in effect. So it is a turnaround COP in a sense. I think it's also a turnaround COP because this year, 1.5 overshoot was acknowledged as inevitable. And here I'm referring to the Paris Agreement's goal to limit the increase in the global average temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. So this was, the elephant in the room during negotiations, a defining goal of the Paris Agreement that we've now failed to meet. I think it's too early to tell what this COP means for the future of the process, but I did feel that it was substantially different in a few ways than previous COPs. And that's because of the pressures that were there in Belém and the pressures that weren't. I mean, the first thing is there was nothing really big on the agenda to negotiate. Countries had submitted their nationally determined contributions, and there were a couple smaller things to wrap up, like the carbon markets, Article 6.4 of the Paris Agreement. But because there was nothing much to negotiate, there was also nothing much to offer. If we think about the economics of the world at this time, the ODA cuts earlier this year from Europe and the U.S. and the future of development aid being in question, I think very much had an effect on the negotiations and the concern for levels of debt burdens, public debt burdens in not just developing countries, but developed countries too. I think there was a real recognition, especially from developed country parties, of the limits of their giving abilities at this time. the geopolitics was another thing that I think was bearing down on negotiations. The war between Russia and Ukraine has brought home new security challenges for Europe that have led to European countries moving a lot more money of their budgets into defense. And this has come at the same time as rising domestic energy prices. There was a story in this morning's Wall Street Journal about how Europe right now is experiencing the worst of both worlds, in the sense that they're currently facing higher prices for energy at the moment and continued reliance on imported fossil fuels. So there's a real sense that the politics that enable ambition in the Paris Agreement framework, in the multilateral negotiations, are not present at the moment.
Yeah, thanks for that, Mike. I think it's fair to say that kind of reactions to COP30 and what happened at the summit are mixed. So I was wondering if we could, first of all, you know, focus on concrete achievements. I mean, you know, from your perspective, what do you see as the most meaningful achievements to emerge from COP30? Where were there decisions, for example, in finance, governance, or inclusion that signal, you know, real progress for the global climate agenda?
There were some meaningful outcomes, including negotiated outcomes. The main decision text was known as the Global Mutirao, and this is an indigenous word for a collective mobilization at all levels. The Global Mutirao text tried to reconcile a few things, a response to nationally determined contributions, which were seen as not strong enough to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. It was a response to the finance challenge and the new collective quantified goal on climate finance, which is the $1.3 trillion mobilization effort. It responded to transparency measures, which are a regular part of the Paris Agreement. And then it responded to a strong interest from parties in trade, specifically unilateral trade measures. I can talk a bit more about that, but that marked, I think, a turning point in these discussions in the COP. The decision text mandated a new 2-year process of consultations, beginning at the subsidiary body meetings in June, on trade. And this is a first. The WTO, the ITC, and UNCTAD will be invited to come to a discussion about trade at the subsidiary body meetings in June. And it's likely that this will be a regular discussion feature of the COP now. There were some other victories. Countries did finish the indicators for the global goal on adaptation, and this is something that's been negotiated for a few years now as a way to measure progress toward adaptation. So it's a fairly technical endeavor, but there's still questions about how to pay for it. Countries will need support to make progress toward these indicators. So that was a lingering concern in the adaptation discussions. Also on adaptation, this was, I think, the negotiated outcome on finance was to triple the amount of adaptation funding by 2035. And this seemed to disappoint both sides to an extent, but it was a concrete outcome on finance that you didn't really see elsewhere in the negotiations. Another aspect that I think was notable came before COP started, during the high-level leader summit and meeting in, I think, Sao Paulo with subnational governments. So cities and states and regions played a big role, not in the formal negotiations, but in the lead-up and outside of COP. And I think it was a very strong signal, both for the future of multilateralism, that subnational entities must be involved, but also the idea that we're moving toward an era of implementation in climate policy, because that's where implementation happens, at the local level. And there's a lot of challenges for subnational entities in receiving access to the kind of financing that is negotiated through the COP. Much of that goes through national governments. So it's bringing some of these issues around implementation to the fore. Another example is that I think emerging economies made a big presence this year, obviously because Brazil was hosting the COP, but also I think on the implementation side. And one of the concerns prior to the COP related to China's NDC, there was some criticism that it was not ambitious enough. On the other hand, at the COP, countries pointed to China producing 70 to 90% of the world's renewables capacity. And so when it comes to implementation, I think China came out looking very good. And finally, I think you saw countries still taking forward important initiatives despite the lack of consensus. One of the biggest issues was around a fossil fuel phase out and including language to that effect in the Global Mutual Out text. Now, controversially, fossil fuel language reference to fossil fuels was not included in that text. However, countries have announced that outside of the negotiations, they're going to be pursuing fossil fuel phase out package, language, and initiative. I think in April, Colombia and the Netherlands are going to be leading this effort. And I think 28 countries have said that they're going to attend. So you have the continued presence, and I think even more important now, of high ambition coalitions that are moving action outside of the negotiations when those negotiations reach their limit.
So a lot of positives to take away from COP30, but I guess we should also focus on the negatives, because there were aspects, I think you'd agree, where COP30 did fall short. What, in your opinion, were the biggest missed opportunities? And from your vantage point, what barriers, you know, whether political, yeah, institutional, or financial, prevented the summit from going further?
Yes, there were several, and I think it was really striking this year as compared to even last year, the immense pressures that are being brought to bear on states and how that's affecting their actions and negotiations. The biggest challenge was that there was no finance on offer. And finance is kind of the glue that keeps the Paris Agreement together. Without that finance, particularly from traditional donor countries, it translates into a lack of ambition or a frustration from other parties, an uncertainty that they'll be able to meet commitments they make in the negotiations if they don't have an expectation of the delivery of finance to support them in getting there. So without finance, without a package to offer, there was a weak response to nationally determined contributions. And this is related to not having language on fossil fuel phase outs in the Mutirao. There's language from the global stocktake from a couple years that points in this direction. And they were unable to use that language, previously agreed language, to phase down the use of fossil fuels. So you might look at it as a step backward on mitigation this year. And I think it's related to countries not having the finance available, the donors especially being able to offer it. The United States not being there was certainly a big influence on the dynamics. It influenced how Europe presented itself. There's sometimes a dynamic where Europeans can look to the US and contrast themselves as showing leadership or more ambition. In other cases, they can point to the U.S. and say, sorry, we hoped to do more, but, you know, this is a consensus process and we need the United States on board. This year, neither was the case. And so you might think that gives an opportunity for Europe to really make a big deal with a high ambition coalition or some group of leaders. The problem is that Europe is facing these unprecedented security concerns and higher prices for domestic energy and a questioning of its ability and commitment to the approach to domestic renewable capacity that it had been pursuing. So the US not being there influenced Europe's capacity and decisions in the negotiations. I think it also influenced what some of the developing countries were prepared to do. Alliances are always being made, strategic alliances, and not having one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful player at the table, limited the scope of options that smaller countries could turn to for leverage. So I think in some ways, this provided more freedom to small island states and least developed countries and some emerging economies, but it also cost some of them leverage that they traditionally enjoyed by making strategic alliances with some developed countries. And I think you see this in the language from especially donor countries are talking more openly about an all of the above approach to energy. I think this is kind of becoming a lot more common with the acknowledgement of 1.5 overshoot, which worries me because we really need to be going in the other direction. But it's also a recognition that there are really, really difficult domestic challenges in donor countries right now, and a system that relies on them to provide public finance to incentivize or to enable developing countries to take ambitious action. Without that, you have a different kind of COP. So that dynamic may not always be the case. Things change. But I think the old way of negotiating, where that big trade-off between finance and mitigation ambition, or that big grand bargain, may be a thing of the past.
I'd like to pivot towards, you know, the research that we've been doing at UNU-CPR. You know, we published several reports in the lead up to COP30. How did the outcomes of COP30 align with the proposals that we brought to the summit? For example, I mean, where did you see convergence with our work on governance reform, on climate finance architecture, or locally led adaptation? And also, where are the gaps that still need to be addressed now going forward?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because a good deal of our climate governance reform work had to do with the outside. So if the inside of climate politics is the UNFCCC, and the outside is all these other institutions that have a stake in addressing climate impacts, like the humanitarian agencies, the multilateral development banks, the IFIs, the private sector. If that's the outside, then our work could be seen more subtly in the negotiations. There was one outcome that really, I think, showed the influence of complexity science thinking, which the presidency had talked a lot about before, and the idea of adaptive and agile new institutions. And that's this idea of a global implementation accelerator. And this was part of the Mucirao decision, but the implementation accelerator is a new facility that's going to help countries enact their NDCs and national adaptation plans. And it's intending to do that through a convening function. So it's not a big fund that waits for money to be put in, but it's a node in a network that is going to coordinate resources and action. And I think that's very much in line with the presidency's understanding of moving to implementation. On the finance issue, I think this is more uncertain. On the one hand, you had a really impressive example of leadership from the COP30 presidency and the government of Brazil in the creation of the Tropical Forest Forever facility. And this is a $125 billion facility. It'll take $25 billion of public money and leverage it into $125 billion of investments. It's a unique facility in that it's designed as more like a sovereign wealth fund. So typically, a kind of facility like this would be a private sector initiative, something like the Nature Conservancy, that's going to, you know, pay a country to not exploit its forests. But this is a sovereign entity within the Brazilian government. So that's a unique feature that I think suggests the stronger role that the state needs to play in the provision and coordination of finance. The Baku to Belém roadmap to 1.3 trillion. This is the initiative from the presidency to operationalize the new collective quantified goal, which calls for the provision of $300 billion in public finance per year by 2035 from developed countries, and a collective mobilization of $1.3 trillion from all sources by 2035. It's unclear to me how this will move forward in the absence of new pledges. So I noted that Brazil had introduced this new facility and it had attracted some good donations to get it up and running. But I'm not aware of any other big pledges that came out of negotiations or even on the action agenda side. I think it's going to be a really tough question how countries come up with the especially public finance that's needed to leverage into the larger 1.3 trillion goal. You know, for the last several years, the climate finance architecture has moved toward this idea of de-risking. And that's where you're taking a small amount of public money and using it strategically to incentivize the private sector to come in a big way. I think we saw in the last couple of years also the kind of limitations to that approach, because you had to a significant degree the private sector and multilateral development banks and IFIs and the COP all aligned around this idea. On the other hand, we're now facing this crisis of ODA. So a lot of that public money is coming as ODA, for instance, to the climate funds. And if you pull the plug on that, even in cutting by 10%, you're calling into question this larger de-risking architecture for climate finance. So what worries me going forward is, on the one hand, how to meet that really critical public finance figure, and on the other hand, maintaining the momentum toward realizing Article 2.1c of the Paris Agreement, which is aligning financial flows with low carbon development pathways. You need the public money and the private money to be working together. But if you don't have the political will to get that initial money for leveraging for things like mitigation and adaptation, and then the sheer just only public funds for things like loss and damage, because that's not investable. If you don't have that, you're really in trouble. And I think that's also, you know, an opportunity or why also some countries are turning to discussing trade. There's a big concern from some developing countries about Europe, especially their CBAM, cross-border adjustment mechanism, which is going to add tariffs based on the percentage of your export that's built with fossil fuel sourced goods or energy. That's going to complicate exports of developing countries and not just China. And so, you know, countries are looking at different ways that they can develop. They're looking at green industrial policy, those countries that are able to do it, which is more emerging economies. And that's where they're going to get the finance they need for climate action, because emerging economies typically don't qualify for a lot of ODA or public transfers from the North, because they're too rich for those, but they're also too poor to do it by themselves. They face too high cost of borrowing to make these investments. So I think trade is related to this question about the future of public finance, but it points to a larger issue about how we fund climate and development.
Just to briefly pick up on the point you made about declining ODA, I was wondering, I mean, if the country is trying to adapt and it needs access to funding, where can a developing country go if ODA is declining?
Yeah, it's a good question. The first place they can look is, of course, the private sector, but they're going to face a pretty high borrowing rate. And the challenge with private sector or FDI for adaptation is it's not that adaptation projects don't provide any return. In fact, they provide a tremendous social return. And if you adapt your economy to climate impacts, then you have an economy that is sustainable and can survive. So it makes possible all of your investments. What it doesn't do is typically provide a clear and direct return to an outside investor, say a big pension fund that wants to make an investment. And I've spoken to some of these funds, and they've said the same thing in the past, which is, we're not against doing the right thing. We want to make investments that support countries. We don't need to take an enormous profit on it, but it does have to be worth our time. And by that, they mean the scale of the investment. So where you find adaptation investments that can turn a profit, they're typically smaller projects, and those don't interest big capital. And for large projects, that return isn't clear, and investors have responsibilities to the people who've trusted their money with them. And so they're generally unwilling to do that without additional support. So another place a country could go is a multilateral development bank or a climate fund. The challenges there become, one, with an MDB, you have to qualify first. So if as a country you make too much money, that's going to limit what you can access. And with climate funds, the access is typically easier, but you have a lot of paperwork and requirements to pitch that project. It's typically project-based. So it's not an easy thing to find general budget support that you need. And that's also what countries need, in addition to resilience, building resilience in physical investments and infrastructure. They need financial resilience. And that, I think, must come in the form of fiscal space, fiscal and monetary policy. So not the way out. The way I see us addressing this new landscape for development finance and climate finance, where the public transfers from donor countries, typical donor countries, that we can't expect those to come back or be increasing in a steady, significant way. The way to address that is to equip developing countries with some of the same tools that developed ones enjoy. And that is the ability to spend countercyclically in a downturn without a major risk to your credit rating. It's the ability to borrow at affordable rates. It's the ability to not have to pay back every liability as soon as an adverse impact hits. Countries need to be able to have the tools to help themselves, and a more equitable distribution of those tools. You know, on the one hand, it's the hardest thing you can do because we're talking about structural reform, changes to the rules of global governance. On the other hand, I think it's compelling, especially right now, because it doesn't cost money today. That is, these are things that donors with political will could do that wouldn't cost their pocketbooks, but that in the end, for vulnerable countries, would, in my opinion, be a lot more valuable than the grant that they wait for and prepare for and hire consultants to apply for and then receive after 2 or 3 years. So this is my thinking around a more full spectrum approach to climate finance, where you're really integrating fiscal and monetary tools and national and regional development banks and local financing and currencies in a more coherent development package.
And this idea of a full spectrum approach to climate finance is something that's in a discussion paper that you published recently with CPR. And I think to try and end on maybe a more positive note, I'd like to look ahead and think about what are the next steps that we can take to sustain momentum or to build on some of the achievements at COP30. From your perspective, are there specific openings, political, financial, or institutional, that you think the international community can now seize to drive forward the reforms and approaches that we as CPR and others have been advocating for?
Absolutely. Let me give you 4 of them. First, I started by talking about subnational engagement at COP, and I might have mentioned the America's All-In Coalition. California Governor Gavin Newsom made a big appearance that received a lot of attention in the press. We also had an event with the African Union Commission, which highlighted resilience efforts in 50 African cities. And what I think both of these efforts together show is that cities need to be closer to the center of this process. It's not the case that you have to change the negotiations in the sense that we need all of these new stakeholders to sit in negotiating rooms and pore over texts. But those texts need to be connected to their needs in a more substantial way. And I think this COP was a step toward that. A second opening is the summit on fossil fuel phase out that will take place in April. This is the summit announced at the General Assembly by Colombia and the Netherlands, and that gained a lot of attention and import during the discussions about a fossil fuel phase out. Not reaching that agreement in the text led several other countries to join on to what became the Belém Declaration on the transition away from fossil fuels. So that's Australia and 23 countries joined this declaration in Belém, and there will be a phase-out summit, an example of a kind of high-ambition coalition taking something from the COP and bringing it closer to the implementation stage where negotiations kind of reach their limit. So that will be a major opportunity. A third is in critical minerals governance. And, you know, this is farther from negotiations, but it's central to both the energy transition and I think to developing countries controlling their own destinies and joining in the benefits of renewable energy. I think right now, this is a really, really under-governed space. And one of the biggest gaps that I see comes at the capacity stage. A developing country, especially a small, lower income one with critical transition materials, doesn't have a lot of good choices. They can open up the doors to multinational corporations and hope for the best, negotiate concessions with them. They can reach agreements with this or that major power. And that'll be tricky as well, because there's a lot of geopolitical pressures that go into those agreements. Or they can keep those materials in the ground and hope that they receive financing or a grant of some kind from a place like the Nature Conservancy, for instance, to keep them in the ground. I think there's a lot more that can be done to support them, especially in this negotiation stage. What I imagine is something like what we're seeing for the borrower's forum on debt. So to use an analog, in the sovereign debt discussions, countries agreed to create a borrower's forum, and that's going to be something that supports heavily indebted countries in the negotiation of their debts. An idea for that could be, you know, you have former finance ministers and people who have worked in those debt renegotiations at a very high level and know where things can go wrong and can advise countries in real time. I can imagine something, a similar effort for critical transition minerals, where countries that are considering exploiting their minerals, but face a lot of decisions about how to do it, with whom to do it, and how to not repeat the mistakes of the past, as some of them have put it to me, in ending up with a resource curse, either something like some of the oil producing countries, where you suddenly have an economy that depends only on this and a rentier state and corruption, or you have something like a traditional raw material exporter where they're dependent on big swings in prices. So prices can be great one year and they can collapse the next. And if your economy is built on that, you're going to be in big trouble. And what they want to avoid is, like I said, repeating mistakes of the past where they have been forced into unfavorable agreements and concessions that were decided in highly unequal negotiations. So I think there's a real opportunity to support vulnerable countries with critical minerals who are going to be exploiting them in the next few years. Those critical minerals are going to fuel the energy transition in big emerging and developed countries. They're also going to enable things like AI, which is going to be, if you believe what people are saying, is going to usher in a new industrial revolution. And it's certainly going to make some people very, very rich. So for me, it's absolutely critical what we do in the next few years on this issue. And if done right, if there are ways where we can standardize sustainable practices and favorable concessions and protections for sustainable resource extraction, I think you can imagine the future for those countries going one of two directions. And one could be very positive and a break from the past. But to do that, I think we need to act in the next couple of years, because that's when those minerals are going to be pulled out. And it's when the huge investments in things like AI are currently being made. So they're going to be supplying the raw materials for this revolution. They already are. And it's absolutely essential that they share a significant slice of any growing pie.
So a lot at stake over the next few years.
Yeah.
Mike, thanks a lot for your time today and your reflections on COP30. It was great to hear your insights and also to hear about how we can build on the achievements of COP30 and address some of the gaps that still remain.
My pleasure, Jack. Thanks very much.
That was Michael Franczak, senior researcher at UNUCPR, on his reflections from COP30 in Berlin. That's it for this episode. You can listen to Multilateralism Unpacked on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other major podcast apps. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you have a moment, leave us a review. See you soon.